comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people that make them and do not necessarily reflect the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or its affiliates or sponsors.
Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thanks for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Talk radio like nowhere else on Earth. It's the show where you matter. Originating now from somewhere on the planet to everywhere else on the planet. Have you subscribed yet to the K-Files e-zine, our free weekly newsletter? Look, if you're not subscribed, really, you need to sit down and get into some deep meditation and ask yourself, where is the genius in that? Because it's absolutely free, and it's a good publication. As a matter of fact, it's an excellent publication, and there are no strings attached, truly no strings attached. And you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. A few people unsubscribe now and again, but most folks stay with us forever. And I invite you to find out why. All right? It's free. So go to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and click where it says K-Files. Tonight, my guest is going to be Ted Tweetmeyer. Now, Ted has been with us many times before. He's always an interesting guest. Ted is an electrical engineer and inventor. And he has done a lot of research into anomalous things, not only on Mars, but throughout our NASA space program. And so we're going to be talking about some rather futuristic science here tonight with Ted Tweetmeyer. And there's an interesting story, and I think an important story, that has come up about some futuristic science. And that is a solar-powered aircraft that this week has made history. Actually, no, last week on Thursday, made history. Solar-powered aircraft, all right? It's not that solar power is assisting in the aircraft. It is the power for the aircraft. Now, the reason this is important is because this aircraft is the first ever to fly solar-powered and be able to fly all through the night. So it flew for just over 26 hours nonstop. It started in the daytime, and its solar cells soaked up all the sun they could, charged up the batteries, so that it would be able to fly through the nighttime. And it was a test to find out if there was sufficient power to make it all the way through the nighttime. In fact, it made it all the way through the nighttime and had about 3 hours of power left in it when it landed. The good thing about it is as the sun came up in the morning, it began charging its depleting batteries again. And so this was really, really, really cool. First time that it's ever been done. It was done in, Sweden, is that correct? And, I'm sorry, not Sweden, Switzerland. That's where it was done. The pilot was Bertrand Piccard, 57 years old. I think that's pretty cool, too. We'll be back right after this. As I stated at the top of the show, my guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer. And Ted has been with us before a number of times, and it's always interesting, compelling information. He is a scientist. He is an inventor and engineer, a developer of technologies, and at points in his life has worked as a contractor, working for a company with a contract with NASA. He's worked as a project manager on some NASA projects, and he is with us tonight for sort of a general rundown on some new high-tech stuff and new discoveries that he has made. And Ted, I want to welcome you back to the Kevin Smith Show.
Hi, Kevin. It's great to be here.
Ted, we're just going to start with some kind of a wide-ranging, maybe wide-ranging, but that's the intention anyway, discussion of some of the things that you have been discovering. And you have been looking into the weirdness of the sun. So why don't we start there, and let's talk about what's going on with the most important thing in the solar system, and that is the solar itself.
Well, I just sent you a little while ago some pictures we should have momentarily. There has been some interesting activity with the sun in regard to the weather we've been having. And I think there's a very strong correlation between this insufferably hot weather that the entire country's been experiencing, which, you know, when you've got a couple million square miles, that's certainly not from any weather front. So there is apparently a connection. So I began to wonder, you know, where is this strange weather coming from? Now, I live in western New York State, and you know, we've had temperatures in the mid to upper 90s, which is very unusual for here. If it gets to 90 in the summer, that's considered high. And, you know, it wasn't only my neck of the woods that was experiencing these issues. It was also, of course, everywhere. And I'm sure folks in places like Arizona were, just absolutely suffocating, because it seems to be proportionately hotter everywhere all of a sudden. So I began to look into this. I thought, well, what's the common source of heat? Well, of course, we all know what that one is, and it's 93 million miles away, and it's a lot bigger than a bread box.
Kind of hard to miss it, you know. You sort of see it every day.
Every day. And then it dawned on me, I remember hearing about a year or so ago that the planets, NASA had found the planets were heating up too. So, you know, the sun sits at a temperature of about 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, we won't use centigrade here, because for most folks that's not a very meaningful issue. And at 11,000 is pretty hot. So, you know, a very tiny, tiny percentage of that number, like 5 decimal places to the right of the decimal point, would represent a few degrees,
mm-hmm.
you know, percent-wise. And anyway, I looked at this, and I looked at the solar pictures, and I've been monitoring them, as you know, since the mid-90s when these things were made available online by, in fact, it was a ham station that made a nice summary of solar images, X-rays, and other plots. And I looked at this, and I began to see some very strange patterns emerging. Polygon shapes on the sun, and other high strangeness going on with certain X-rays, you know, elevated levels. Let me put this in perspective. The GOES satellite, G-O-E-S, is a geostationary orbiting Earth satellite. And it actually, its function is to monitor the Earth and the sun. Well, and everybody knows about SOHO. Everybody talks about SOHO, but not too many people talk about the GOES satellite, which also takes pictures at various X-ray wavelengths with filters. Well, a few years ago, actually about maybe 2 years ago, NASA thought that one of the sensors on the satellite had failed because they were getting a straight line in the chart.
I remember us talking about that. You came on the show and talked about it when it happened.
I certainly did. And the curious thing about this, okay, is that this same, this is really interesting, the same sensor does several different wavelengths, and what they do is they use filters in front of it. Now, with, you know, light, you use red, green, blue filters. At X-ray wavelengths, you use solid materials like aluminum and plastic, which certain materials will act as filters. And so to say the sensor failed when some things were sensed and not others is not correct. And indeed, those straight red lines aren't straight red lines anymore. They're elevated. So what happened is there was a suddenly a extremely low level of X-rays, perhaps too low for the sensor to even measure, coming from the sun. It's as though they almost stopped altogether, which is quite astounding considering, you know, it's still functioning.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what happened? Well, I looked at this, and I noticed here a few days back, and you'll see some charts I sent a few days ago that they end right up at the point I collected the data. That's why the chart just abruptly ends about three-quarters of the way across. And, you know, and there it was, an increase in these various X-rays, i.e. solar activity, and of course the temperatures were going up. And last Thursday it went up into the high 90s, and tomorrow it's going to be up in the high 90s. It's as though, at least here in western New York, the weather pattern has completely repeated itself this week that it did last week. And, you know, it was getting pretty hot today, and tomorrow it's supposed to be the hottest, I guess possibly the hottest day of the week. So, you know, I can't say I've had time to collect data this week, but certainly last week was quite amazing. And then, on top of all that, there were the images of the sun showing very strange shapes on it. So something's changed with our local star. I don't know precisely what it is, but something has changed.
All right, let's park there and let me ask a couple of questions. Are you finding, am I understanding that what you're finding is that there seems to be a correlation between the X-ray output and the temperatures?
Well, what I there does seem to be. Now, obviously X-rays aren't heat, so please don't flood my inbox or Kevin's phone lines. We all know that distinction. But X-rays are certainly indicative of the level of fusion activity going on. And we're talking about, you know, magnitudes of change here. We're not talking about little bits of change. These charts are calibrated in like 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 7th power. You're talking what they call scientifically a magnitude, which is, in other words, adding another zero on. So, you know, we're talking about increments of 10, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so...
So you, for instance, a 1,000 would become a 10,000.
Yeah, that type of thing. It's kind of like the Richter scale, you know, which is not exactly linear. You know, each one is so many times the level before it and so forth. But the point we're making here is something's changing with our star, and we can talk about in a little bit here the 11-year cycle versus the 6-month solar heartbeat.
Okay, but before we do that, I want to talk about something else that you've just mentioned, and that is strange shapes on the sun. You mentioned polygon shapes on the sun. What's all that about?
You know, I'm not really sure. They show up. Some show up in visible light. Some only show up in X-ray spectrum photographs. The one thing that has been happening is there's now coronal mass ejections, which, for folks that aren't familiar with that, most people know about solar flares, which are like great big stretched out loops where plasma from the sun loops out and Earth, you know, the sun's magnetic field pulls the plasma back in. They call those M class flares, Emma's and Mary. But X class are where the material leaves the sun and does not return. And when they hit the Earth, all kinds of trouble is unleashed. And it can be bad for satellites and everything else, because it's basically, when it gets here, it's pure radiation, extremely high levels of radiation. And
now, it takes light approximately 8 minutes to get from the sun to us. How long does it take for one of these flares, which is, I would assume, particulate, to travel from the sun to us?
Well, there's different schools of thought on that, and they travel at different velocities. You know, typically it's like 24 hours, although they have found with some stars that, a CME can leave a star at nearly the speed of light. That's a tremendous burst of energy. So, you're talking 24 hours to who knows, minutes or a few hours, maybe worst case. But, they can see it happen, and then they can measure it not long after it happens, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, and actually, it's only a point of interest because there's no place to go hide.
Yes, that's true, and... there's only a certain amount of shielding on the space station, which is a real curious problem, because the sun is not completely predictable, not as predictable as they certainly would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're supposed to have our next solar max in just 2 years' time. Well, that's interesting from the standpoint that the sun has been dead quiet the last 2 years or so. In fact, we had record periods of time with no flares at all, absolutely nothing happening. It was as quiet as though somebody gave it a big shot of anesthetic and put it to sleep. It was really quiet. Then all of a sudden it starts acting up, and so does the weather with it. Now, it seems a little bit too coincidental.
All right. Let's talk about this six-month cycle as opposed to the 11-year cycle.
Okay. It's been known for many decades we have this 11-year period where the sun goes from a minimum activity to a maximum. Well, a couple of years ago, maybe 3 years ago, one of the universities discovered what they call a solar heartbeat. Now, the solar heartbeat is considered to be a period of time where it waxes and wanes within that 11-year cycle, and it does so every 6 months, or twice a year, if you will. Well, the solar heartbeat, you could think of as a wave function. And I kind of liken it to take a nice still pond, and off to your right throw a small rock in. Then off to your left, throw another rock in. And you'll see the two waves, will slowly come out as rings, and then some will hit each other, and some will actually increase in size, and some will decrease. That's known as the standing wave function, basically. So waves are like vectors, and, if you either add or subtract the energies involved. So now, here we have... on a much, much, much longer period of time, instead of measured in a few seconds, we're talking, many months to years, you've got the period of time where the sun is active or reaching solar max, and then you got this other wave function going on in there as well. And I've yet to read any information or data on what happens when these two collide with each other. And... what could, perhaps, just perhaps, maybe that's what's happened to our weather lately.
If the sun did not have the waxing and waning of its activity, it would seem to me that fusion would create an ever-growing, expanding situation until you had an explosion of the star.
Like a supernova, you mean?
Yeah. And so it's sort of like inhale, exhale. And so it's got to do the expanding and the contracting, the waxing and waning, in my understanding of it, in order for it not to go supernova. Now, maybe that's wrong, but that's the way I understand it. And if I'm wrong, you can correct me. But are we seeing a change in the waxing and waning?
Well, you know, that's an excellent question. And what does the change mean, and how is it happening? Our biggest fundamental problem is we don't fully understand how it functions. We have an awful lot of theories. You know, there's absolutely no way to send a probe to the middle of it and say, oh, well, look what's going on here.
You could send it at nighttime.
Very good, Kevin. I like that.
Yeah, it's an old joke, but folks, you have to forgive me. I'm an old guy. All my jokes are old. I'm sorry, Ted. Go ahead.
It's like the guy said to the healer, when did you start healing? And he said, right after I cut my finger. what's happening is fascinating from a lot of different standpoints, and it shows really how little I think we fully understand what our nearest neighbor is doing. And the size of the sun is, you know, we're so used to seeing that little thing up in the sky, but it is so many thousand times larger than the Earth. It's mind-boggling. And what's even more amazing is, you know, here you have a star that warps space enough to keep a planet like, oh, excuse me, planetoid, like Pluto in orbit, okay, that far away, and yet it can eject some of its mass into space right off its surface, and it doesn't come back. That to me is almost a contradiction of terms. Yeah.
Think of the escape velocity necessary. Just to get off of this planet, the gravity here is fairly weak, relatively weak.
As I recall, the escape velocity of Earth is 14,000-something miles an hour.
Just to get off of Earth. Now, to get away from the sun, what must the escape velocity be? Well, we'll talk about that and a few other things when we come back from this break. We'll be back, folks, right after this. This is the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Ted Tweetmeyer. Ted.
Yes.
We're talking about gravity and escape velocity. Let me ask you a question.
By the way, I have answers to that, but go ahead.
I'm sorry?
I have some answers to those numbers.
Let's go ahead with that then. What's the escape velocity from the sun?
Well, let's put it in perspective, okay? For the moon, it's 2.4 kilometers per second. For the Earth, it's 11.2 kilometers per second. For the Sun, it's 617 kilometers per second. So it's pretty big.
So it takes a heck of an explosion to launch a CME that's not coming back, a CME that's an X-class.
Yes, it would. It would take a tremendous amount of explosion and a tremendous amount of force to go with it, too, yeah.
Okay. We're talking about forces, various types of forces. All forces, as far as I can tell, at some point involve waves, some kind of waves. Now, there is a lot of talk about gravity waves, and there are scientists that say they exist, there are scientists that say they don't exist, or maybe they exist, but it hasn't actually been detected. isolated and analyzed. So, you know, they're on the sideline. All right. Would, well, let me add one more thing to this. The sun is not hanging out there stationary in space. It is moving at a rather fast clip. And it's dragging what we call the solar system with it.
It takes like 26,000 years to go all the way around the Milky Way.
Yeah. All right. As it moves, it obviously must be propagating some wave force in front, beside, and behind it. Another massive body approaching would be doing the same thing. Would it be possible that the waves of gravity, magnetism, other types of waves associated with another massive body may be intersecting the waves coming off of the sun as this massive body approaches, and could that account for the disturbance in what we think of as normal sun activity?
Well, it's possible. There's interactions of, I mean, there is an unbelievably delicate balance between the sun and Earth. Someone has observed that when there's a solar flare, there's going to be an earthquake. And they've got it right down to the point where they know pretty close to exactly where on Earth it's going to hit. So, and they've been pretty accurate about it. So there is... you know, there is a invisible cable, if you will, a tether, so to speak, between Earth and the sun. And, you know, you pull on one end of that, something happens on the other end. I think maybe that's one analogy to use anyway.
Okay, so a massive body of some kind approaching, maybe, look, I bring this up because we hear a lot about Nibiru, Planet X, and I'm not saying it's either one of those. What I'm saying is a massive body approaching our solar system, maybe close enough to pass actually through our solar system, but maybe not. But close enough that its wave, attendant wave activity could be intersecting the attendant wave activity of the sun. Would there not be the same kind of disturbance and relationship as the sun with the Earth?
Yeah, well, you make a good point. The wave theory is pretty universal, whether it's water or electrical signals. You know, they behave the same way. Years ago, people would put CB radios in vehicles, and you had to match the antenna to the radio.
Yes.
You know, and probably a lot of listeners may or may not be familiar with that, but that involved tuning the antenna to the radio and the coax, and that was done with a meter. They called it an SWR meter for standing wave ratio. In fact, that's what it measured, was how much energy that was sent out of the radio to the antenna actually came back toward the radio. And, of course, if it wasn't a perfect match, you know, there was a considerable amount of RF energy from the radio that would, instead of going out the antenna and giving you better distance, it would be reflected back at the radio. And so the wave theory applies to all sorts of different things. It's pretty universal in nature almost, and it's curiously got to do with sine waves. You know, this is I've actually seen, you know, unmatched cables have all kinds of gain problems, you know, gain flatness problems, because you know, they're not matched, so certain frequencies cause problems. And, you know, we have this delicate dance going on between the sun and the planets. And, you know, we're only now, I think, we're just starting to realize, you know, the fine equilibrium that's going on there.
All right, so... if, let's take your example of throwing a rock to the right and a rock to the left in the same pond. When those waves do intersect, when those, we call them ripples, but a ripple is a wave. When those waves do intersect, they make patterns. as they intersect, and one is dominant and one is recessive, or they're both trying to be dominant, and they make patterns in the water momentarily as they intersect. Could that account for the patterns, the shapes that you're seeing on the sun?
Well, perhaps so. If you get a chance, take a look at the photos I sent you a while ago. You might find that intriguing.
Yeah, well, it'll have to be after the show. There's no way for me to open it and look at it during the show.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think you'll find that interesting. But there are these various, I outline in these pictures some, you know, hexagonal and pentagon patterns that are showing up. And square patterns. A square flare. And curiously enough, I went looking back in my archive, and there was the same flare, the same shape, in the same exact spot on the sun, the same, you know, over to the right side of the horizon. I was amazed at how close those two actually were, and that was taken like 2 years ago. And, you know, here it looks just like a square, like somebody stamped it in there. Where this flare is taking place. So there's it's all completely random in what the sun does. I really don't.
Well, we do know that the 11-year cycle is way, way off of the predictions.
Uh-huh.
It's not acting as was predicted. But they say that when it reaches maximum, it's supposed to be a real, and if you'll pardon the pun, barn burner. We've got, what, 2 years left in this cycle?
About that, yeah.
About 18 months, right?
Yeah, 2012. I hate to utter the words, but that's when it is, yeah.
Okay, that means if it's going to be catching up, to produce what they have predicted, it has to come roaring back to life.
And it seems to be starting to do just that. You know, with this flurry of flare activity and other things going on, it's like it's suddenly woken up somehow.
In 1983, a scientist with NASA, who was, I believe he was the chief scientist for the IRAS, I-R-A-S, satellite, made an announcement that was published in the Washington Times or Washington Post, I forget which one, and it was carried by a couple of other newspapers, and then that was it. You heard nothing else. And his announcement was, we have found something out there. We don't know what it is, but it's huge.
That's interesting, because there's currently over 1,000 potentially hazardous asteroids. The count's been slowly going up every month, one or two here and there, that are big enough to either destroy a continent or even cause a worldwide event. And those are the big ones. Those, you know, there's many, many thousands of smaller ones, some that come in that often are called bolides or meteors. And so it wouldn't surprise me if there's something even bigger than these, you know, 1 mile to 10 mile or so objects out there that are on this list.
Well, at some point, now, look, I'm going to say to you and to all the folks listening, here is a disclaimer. I'm remembering this, and I'm not sure I'm remembering this correctly, okay? But it seems to me that I read that he said, and it, by the way, I think his name was Neuberger, something like that. Same scientist that said we found something huge out there. It seems that somewhere I read that he had said that it could possibly be as large as Jupiter.
Mm.
Now, please, folks, don't go out and say Kevin Smith said that's the case. Kevin Smith said his old mind is remembering that, and it may not be an accurate memory, but I think that's the case. And some of our listeners will be able to go on the internet, research that real quick, and when we open the phones later, you can tell me if that's correct or not. But surely something that size, if it were as big as Jupiter, and if it were approaching our solar system, would be significant enough to cause some wave disturbance, I would think.
I would think so too. I mean, there's every object warps space, and I often refer to the classic Cavendish experiment, where you take a really big lead ball, I'm sorry, and you place beside it on a like a balanced beam a copper sphere. And it will actually attract the copper sphere to the lead ball. And it does so because even though it's sitting on Earth, the lead ball actually has its own gravity because it has enough mass to bend the local space-time, and it actually will pull the copper sphere toward it. So that was done in 1770-something. I forgot the exact year. But, I mean, that goes back a long time. So, yes, it's true. You know, and you're talking something really massive out there. It very well could interact with the current celestial objects in our solar system.
All right, now, let me ask another question. No, I just looked at the clock, and we're only seconds away from break. I'll hold this question. When we come back, I'll ask it. And it has to do with waves and friction. But we'll get to that when we come back. All right, folks, we will be back right after this. More with my guest, Ted Tweetmeyer. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening, Ted Tweetmeyer. And Ted, when we went away for break, I said I have a question for you about waves and friction.
Oh, well, before you get into that, I do have an answer for you. And it was 1983.
Uh-huh.
Dr. Jerry Neugebauer, the IRIS chief scientist for JPL and director of the Palomar Observatory, said in an interview, "All I can tell you is we don't know what it is." They said it's a heavenly body, possibly as large as a giant planet, Jupiter, and possibly so close to Earth that it would be part of the solar system. And it's been found in the direction of the constellation Orion by an orbiting telescope aboard the U.S. Infrared Astronomical Satellite, otherwise known as IRIS. So there you have it.
Well, a point for my old mind.
Yes, it's still functioning, isn't it?
The waves have not gotten to it yet.
That's right. No spider webs. No,
well, I don't know about that, but... okay. Waves are not imaginary. And they are, at some level... there are all kinds... Look, people argue whether photons are particulate or wave. Okay, but at some level, every wave has particulate properties. It's moving something. If all the particulates that it's moving are not part of the wave, they're still being moved by the wave. And this is how our microwave ovens work. Okay, now, let's assume that this big heavenly body, this huge body out there, maybe the one that Dr. What did you say, Neugebauer?
Yeah, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, N-E-U-G-E-B-A-U-R.
Maybe the same one, I don't know. But we'll for the sake of example, we'll say that's it. As it's moving, if it's moving nearer our solar system, its wave properties at some point have to intersect the wave properties of our sun and other wave properties of bodies within the solar system. And as the waves intersect, there has to be friction that has to create some type of radiation, which can and probably would create some type of heat.
Well, consider the moon, okay? There's a perfect example of what we're talking about. You know, it varies between 250,000 and 350,000 miles away, and yet it can pull on the tides of Earth, and it can actually, it changes the shape of the Earth as it goes around it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's an example right there, and that's, compared to what we're talking about, that's a really small body up there.
Yes, it is. Okay, as a matter of fact, it's smaller than a BB by comparison.
Yeah.
Okay. So if that's happening, could that be a logical, reasonable, rational explanation for why all of the planets of the solar system are heating up?
Perhaps. And, you know, and of course there's also an indirect effect where this object's affecting the sun, which in turn is causing the planets to heat up too. So there's a lot of complex things going on, I think, with these processes.
All right, let's work backwards from what is observed. And if we take a look at what you have observed about the sun, does it appear to you that the sun is being acted upon by something outside itself?
Well, you know, looking at those perfect, nearly virtually perfect geometric shapes, it does look like something is happening to it somehow. There is something going on, and that almost gets into the realm of the simulated reality I think I might have talked to you about one time. That could be a whole nother show. I don't know.
You know, what we need to do is a simulated show on that.
Hmm.
What do you think?
A simulated, Phil, I'm sorry.
Yeah, a simulated show on simulated reality.
Yes, that's right. The show you're listening to isn't real. You're imagining.
That's right.
Listening.
Okay. Now, you quite obviously, I mean, you know that my interest in all of this is because we keep hearing about Nibiru, we keep hearing about Planet X, and we keep hearing scientists saying there's no such thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going, for the sake of argument, to stipulate there's no Nibiru. Doesn't mean I agree with that, but I'll stipulate to that. I'll stipulate to there's no Planet X. I cannot stipulate to the idea that there's no giant body as large as Jupiter that's been discovered by NASA, because they've already admitted it. And at one point or another, that body has to be in a position to have some kind of interaction with our solar system. Why, and let me ask you as a scientist, why did the story surface in 1983, die in 1983, and has never been revisited?
I think I can possibly answer that question.
Okay.
Based on something that happened.
All right.
There was a panic started sometime around that period of time that, you know, there was an astronomer, I remember a story, there was an astronomer released a story straight to the media that there was something on a collision course with Earth. You probably might remember one of those early stories.
Mm-hmm.
And this created a bit of a panic. So then a clearinghouse was established that all professional astronomers had to go through with these types of stories. And then it would be decided whether or not it would be released to the media.
Mm-hmm.
And there still is a clearinghouse for that. And, of course, Uncle Sam runs a clearinghouse, so they don't want to ensue panic unnecessarily. So what they probably would do is look for independent confirmation and and so forth and so on. So that could be why you don't hear these stories anymore.
That clearinghouse is the International Astronomical Telegram Bureau, and is part of the International Astronomical Union or Association. And I've done research on that and discovered that the policies that they adhere to were not developed by them entirely, but this may come as a surprise to you, and maybe not. Do you know who sits at the top of the pile? SETI. That's a fact.
Yeah. I always thought SETI stood for something like, shucks, ETs don't exist or something.
SETI sits at the top of the pile of suppression of information. Now, this International Bureau of Astronomical Telegrams, or whatever it's called, I forget now, I've done a couple of shows on it, admits in their own publications, and I made those public, but and by the way, Robert Morningstar found it and sent it to me, but they admit in one of their own annual reports suppressing the discovery of several minor planets within our solar system.
Yeah, and meanwhile they demote Pluto to be a planetoid, and they haven't even had a satellite go out and take a picture of it.
Yeah, how about that? That's pretty cool.
That's
pretty cruel.
It's a cold, calculated thing they did to that little cold rock.
Well, it is, but see, all of this indicates to me that there's something really, really big up. You discover. And their own annual report, I believe it was in 74, but it's reporting on activities for 1973. But those years may be wrong. Anyway, they say in their own report that these discoveries of minor planets, and that's what they called them, minor planets within our solar system, were confirmed by several astronomers and astronomical observatories and groups. They were confirmed by several, and the decision was made to suppress, and they use that word, to suppress this information, even from their own members. They didn't send out notices to the membership of the International Astronomical Union to announce this. They suppressed it and sent it to the Minor Planets Division or something like that of the International Astronomical Union. So, you know, they admit suppression of information, and I think it's because there's something huge up. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. Now, for those of you who are joining us just now in this second hour, you have my most sincere sympathy and condolences for whatever it is that kept you away from that first hour of literal universes of information. But we're glad you're here now. My guest is Ted Tweetmeyer, scientist, engineer, and inventor. And we're talking about some heavy, heavy stuff. Ted, when we went away for break, I was talking about these minor planets that the International Astronomical Union was not informed about because their sub-department, the Bureau for Astronomical Telegrams, that's who makes official notification to the members of new discoveries. And that's who makes official notification to the press. Okay. They decided to suppress the discovery of those minor planets, several, they said, several minor planets in our solar system. All right. Now, having done that, you got to ask yourself the question, well, why? That's big news. When they found Sedna out there beyond Pluto, that Sedna was announced. But several minor planets, Sedna, they said, is a planetoid, and they've reduced Pluto to that. But several minor planets in our solar system, and we were never told about them. All right, now, why would that be? Unless there's something really anomalous about those planets they don't want everyone to know, because it could cause a panic. What possibly could be anomalous about them that would do that?
Well, if they're orbiting something else, which is the whole thing is on the move.
Well, see, that's what we hear about Nibiru.
I suppose that is true. I wasn't really thinking about that, but I suppose there's... I mean, there's a lot of possibilities, and of course, until we actually can see something with a telescope, satellite, or something, it's pretty tough to know. But
well, see, but astronomers have seen it, reported it, and the official watchdog of the information put a lid on it. And several astronomers and observatories have seen them. They have verified each other's work. And the watchdogs put a lid on this information and didn't even publish that to their own membership.
Yes, and you wonder why. I mean, this is... I've had a problem. I have a kind of a pet peeve with astronomy. They seem to engage in some of the most wild, crazy theories, and it's like there's no one to keep them in check or keep them under control. I mean, like, I think the whole business with comets was one I never could quite swallow. And, you know, oh, it's a dirty snowball. Yeah, okay, it's going to generate this tail several million miles long into space, like it's manufacturing the water out of thin air or something. I mean, you know, and do this every time it goes near the sun. And then, of course, when they fire that large projectile from a satellite into, I believe it was Halley's Comet that they intercepted, you know, and they found it wasn't made out of what they thought it was at all. And then, of course, then we didn't hear any more about that. You know?
Yeah, it wasn't a snowball.
No, it wasn't. In fact, they said it was kind of gravelly in nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it's almost along the lines of the fusion people. That's another one of my pet peeves, you know. We need a bigger magnet, you know. We need a bigger machine. It's not big enough. And we need another $5 or $10 billion. And, I mean, it's just, it's crazy.
Well, I tell you what I'd like to do. I would like to invite our audience to join us and participate in the conversation. And, folks, the telephone lines are open at this point. The telephone number is 623-444-5889, and that number will work from anywhere on this planet. 623-444-5889. If you are on an approaching planet X, you may be close enough that phone number will work from there. Toll-free in the USA and Canada, 888-223-4599. And if you're outside of the USA and you're outside of Canada, I don't have an international toll-free number. You can call our main number or go to my website and scroll down. You'll see something that says Flash Message. Click that, and you can send your question or comment that way. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yeah, good evening, gentlemen. This is Terry from Ohio, and I got my feet firmly on the only planet I'll probably ever be on, and with my luck, the only thing that will happen, I'll end up underneath it.
Okay, now your feet are firmly planted on the only planet you'll ever be on, but which one?
Earth.
Okay. All right, Terry, go ahead.
I just wonder, are you the one you was talking about, that scientist and that satellite, is that the one that they sent out there and they burned it all up, you know, tracking this thing and watching it for, you know, until they, you know, the satellite ran out of fuel and couldn't watch it anymore?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I haven't heard of that happening.
That's why I heard that they sent a satellite out and they spotted this thing and they said it went dead or broke or something, but they actually used it.
Oh, that's been within the past 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this was 1983, and when he released that information, so it would have been 82 or 83 when it happened.
I see. Right. Yeah, I remember just hearing that they, you know, they said it broke or something. They lied to us, but yet they used the fuel all up just to watch this thing they seen out there. But my theory is, you know, okay, this thing's supposed to come around every how often?
Well, we don't know. I mean, if it's Nibiru, it's supposed to be every 3,600 years. That's the information. But, you know, at this point, we don't know if it's Nibiru or some other planet X or this thing discovered in 1983 or nothing at all.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying, you know, Nibiru, you know, if this thing was true, and the time period that this thing laps around, our little area here in the universe would be still in chaos, and there wouldn't be no life anywhere if this thing come through, you know, playing ping pong with everybody. There would be no time to life would be we'd be barely starting up again. So you know, that's totally retarded, you know, ridiculous. You know, if you ask me.
Terry, take a deep breath. Relax, and then tell us what you really think.
But I do believe, you know, and they talk about things, okay, pulling on stuff. I mean, if they're worried about the galactic center, I mean, we're close enough to it now that if there's anything coming out of it, you know, they could launch a spacecraft, you know, and, you know, they could have known what's coming out of that thing or not, you know, a long, long, long time ago.
And how do you know they don't?
Well, that's what I'm saying, you know.
The actions of suppression of information indicates to me that there is something big afoot and they don't want you to know it.
Well, I think that's true, too. But, you know, it could be on a scale of just, not as something amazing or disastrous, but just things that we could actually be free. You know, we were born to be free, you know, and we could take these clowns, you know, and, you know, best thing we could do is, you know, round them up and, well, I won't say anymore, but, you know, and, you know, and we're more powerful than, you know, we're brainwashed and...
Yeah, but what does that have to do with the sun and the wave activity and the planet that possibly is coming in?
Well, yeah, if something's coming in, you know, we always got that chance, you know, because we got all those big meteors out there, you know. I can't even start to speculate on that. As far as the sun... I mean, it's been up and down. You know, we've only been watching it for, 20 years? And, you know, yeah, we're into a Y. We found a Y, you know, it burped. But, you know, there's a lot of things. You know, weather's changed quite a bit in time, you know, and we've only been watching it for such a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, who says what the extreme is, you know?
Well, that's a good point. Terry, thanks for the call. Ted, what do you think? We haven't been watching it for all that long, the sun. So since we haven't been watching it for all that long, how do we really know what is normal?
Well, it's worth noting that a couple thousand years ago, the Chinese recorded a solar flare. It's just, you know, I guess in the last 20, 30 years, our technology has become more... sophisticated, and we can now analyze, you know, things like X-rays from the sun that we couldn't measure on Earth. You know, but some of its behavior is, you know, is pretty consistent. But I don't think I've really seen much that ties solar activity to Earth weather. I mean, if there is, you sure don't hear about it very much.
I thought that was your point at the beginning, and that is that there seems to be some correlation between the heat waves and the solar activity.
Right, that is my point. But what I mean is you don't hear about it from really any mainstream anything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I was really trying to say there.
Yeah. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hi, John from Vancouver Island.
Hello, John.
Hi.
Hi. Hi, Ted. I missed the first half an hour, but do you post on RENS regarding free energy articles?
I haven't written anything on there in quite some time, and my website, the hosting service just disappeared one day. It just vanished, and I'm unable to reach them. So I haven't had the time to really launch another one. We do have all the files for it. It's just a matter of doing it, okay. Uploading them. That's a lot.
Yeah, I just wanted to say I noticed them, and they really caught my attention. I thought they were really cool.
Thank you. I just get this inspiration to write, and it could hit me at, you know, 10 o'clock at night or 3 in the morning, and I just start writing, and sometimes I send it.
That sounds very unscientific.
Doesn't it? Yes. But not everything is all science-based, I write. But
right, right.
You know, but...
Okay. the reason I'm calling is I just wanted to delve into the particle-wave duality just a little bit.
Okay.
Okay. Take, for example, a photon when it gets released.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it gets shot out like a cannon. It doesn't have momentum. It doesn't have mass. Nothing like that. And yet it goes in a straight line.
And?
So, hello?
Yeah.
Please continue. You're going to run out of time with all those pauses.
All right. Okay, so the only way that it could go in a straight line is if it did a spin. It would create its own axis by spinning, and using that axis, it would know how to go in a straight line, and then the spin would create the wave pattern. So that's how I resolve the particle-wave duality.
I have a friend who did some pretty incredible research work back in the 90s, and he sent me his photon electron model. And he sent this to me, called it the Y-gem. And he just, at that time, he had found that. Probably won't read this in any textbook, but the photon was made of 918 pairs of electrons. What made it interesting is there's two parallel tubes down through the center of a photon. And I just tucked his sketch away that he drew and emailed me and opened a... Are you familiar with Nature magazine?
I am, yeah.
Okay, I mean, that's, if you're a scientist, that's like the place to be published, you know? It's like getting your name in the Bible almost. And I opened it up one day, and there was a scanning tunneling microscope photograph, and there it was, one peak pointing up and one pointing down. And all he would say about it is, in this large false color 2D perspective, is they didn't know what those were. Well, my friend Warren had isolated them, and actually zero-point energy takes place in those two tubes that go down through the center of a photon. So,
yeah.
kind of intriguing.
All right. John, thank you so much for the call. I think what I would say about photons is, regardless of whether they have mass, regardless of whether they are energy, raw energy, or particulate, if it's moving, it creates waves, whatever it is. And waves move particles.
There was one thing Einstein said, that the photon, if, you know, has like this virtually unlimited amount of energy associated with it. Actually, that was the sound of the error buzzer going off, because there's one scientist that slowed photons down to 38 miles an hour and could speed them back up again. And then another laboratory stopped them in a Bose-Einstein condensate, and then sent them on their way again as well. So, the theory was that it would take, you know, infinite energy to accelerate something to the speed of light, and yet it doesn't. And that if, you know, slow light down, you'd release unlimited energy. Well, it didn't, because the laboratories are still there.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you slow photons down to 38 miles per hour, and then you let them go on their way, they go on their way at the speed of light, do they not?
They can be reaccelerated back to the speed of light.
So the existence of light is proof that it does not take infinite energy to move at the speed of light, else light could not be accelerated to the speed of light.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the problems. It's one of the paradoxes, you know. Is a particle a wave, you know? And yes, a particle can act like a wave.
Well, but you see what I'm saying, though? All of that other stuff about whether it's a wave or it's not, if whatever it is, if you move it, it creates a wave.
Uh-huh.
Once you accelerate anything, then there are a couple of things that have to happen, and that is a wave and frequencies. Anything in motion is producing waves and frequencies, and it has to. And then each frequency is creating harmonics. And since everything that is a frequency has harmonics being created around it, that would mean then that every wave is moving like a sphere, because the frequencies and the harmonics are being given off around whatever's moving in a 360 by 360 degree circle. That's a sphere.
Yeah, a pure sine wave actually really wouldn't have any harmonics.
Well, a sine wave would not. That's true.
Unless it interacted with something that caused it to resonate at some other frequency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's, of course, what happens in radio equipment, where a crystal can oscillate at its third harmonic of its fundamental. So, yeah, there's you could do a whole show on this whole subject.
And we may have to do that.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm getting at then is that if we work backward from what is being observed on the sun, we take what's observed and we say, what can cause that? It appears that, or to me, it appears that what's happening is the sun is being acted upon by forces outside itself. And that can't happen without the sun's forces interacting with those forces.
I think we could almost classify this as two kinds of forces: either a natural force from some object, or an artificially induced force produced intelligently.
Well, now we're going to have to dive off into that in just a second. Let's take this phone call. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hey, hi, Kevin. This is Perry from San Luis Obispo, California.
Hi, Perry.
Hi.
Earlier on in the show, there was some mention about polygon-shaped objects close to the sun. And I'm wondering if the guest is aware of what James Horak has said what those are.
Well, let's let Ted respond, but I don't think he said they were close to the sun. I think he said they're on the sun.
Yeah. we're talking about features on the surface of the sun itself, flares and other things that are taking on these symmetrical shapes.
Okay, so you're not talking about things that were captured on SOHO cameras?
No.
That are like in the atmosphere of the sun?
And you mean in the chronosphere or chromosphere?
Yeah.
No,
mm-hmm.
Not those. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about CCD artifacts and dirt and dust and things like that.
Do you think that's what that is, Ted?
No, not what I was looking at. But
okay.
Some other things can be misinterpreted. That's certainly not beyond the realm of possibility. There's so much junk up there. But these are massive features. You know, thousands of miles in size. Of course, anything you anything you can see on the sun from Earth, it has to be incredibly huge. In fact, I've seen some satellite photos when Mercury passing in front of the sun. There's this little itty bitty tiny little round dot. You know, it's staggeringly small compared to the sun. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Would you happen to, do you think that any of these polygon shapes have anything remotely to do or included in the study known as sacred geometry? Like, are these shapes shapes that are found in sacred geometry type figures that some may think can't come from electromagnetic or something.
Okay, Perry, we're going to have to step away for a break.
Okay.
We'll let him answer that when we come back, and I want to thank you for the call. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest this evening, Ted Tweetmeyer. Ted, when we went away for break, Perry in California had just asked a question, and that is, do you think any of these shapes you've observed on the sun have any connection with sacred geometry?
That's a really good question he asked, because one of the areas that's been making some waves and physics is a very hyperdimensional physics that came out a few years ago, and many have talked about this. And I understand from somebody that's more familiar with it than I am that it looks like a little clock with hands that they put in the equations to. So when that's figured into the formulas and equations for calculating satellite trajectories, they're finding that now they can more accurately plot where the satellite should be at a given point in its journey, because before they considered that, they would be off quite a bit. So now this whole hyperdimensional thing gets into these complex nested geometrical shapes that form points at equidistant points. Locations around an object. I think Richard Hoagland said 19.5 degrees, or I think it's technically 19.47 to be exact. But so, yeah, I mean, it's possible that maybe there's a connection between all of that and the sacred geometry a lot of people talk about, and it may turn out that sacred geometry basically is hyperdimensional physics.
All right. Is hyperdimensional physics causal, or is it an effect of something else?
Well, that's a good question. It's a whole different way of looking at everything, and you know, it's a chicken egg situation, right?
Well, and it believe it all comes down to which story of origins you choose to believe, as to whether it was the chicken or the egg.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it may be that when you, you know, just have a massive object in space, that this just kind of, this hyperdimensional physics thing might actually just create itself. You know, just like, you know, a massive object in space automatically creates gravity, well, you know, and warps the fabric of space-time, then perhaps this hyperdimensional aspect is just another part of the expression of mass.
You brought up something earlier, and I want us to explore it just a minute. Let me give the telephone numbers again very quickly. 623-444-5889 or 888-223-4599. And we also have a flash message that we're going to get to. But you said that these phenomena that you're observing on the sun, these shapes and the activity or lack thereof, on the sun, could either be a result of some kind of natural forces, as in a very large body moving closer to our sun, or it could be intelligently caused by something or someone. Now, you can't leave that hanging. Who do you have in mind?
Well, I liken this to the issue of these space objects. And to put this in perspective, this is an analogy.
Okay, we have just lost your audio, Mr. Tweetmeyer, and yet I still show that you are online with me. So, what has happened? Maybe that's some situation that he was about to say something they don't want him to say. Tell you what we'll do. We will attempt. I don't see what's happened here. Something weird has happened. All right. Well, we will attempt to get Mr. Tweetmeyer back on the telephone with us. And all right, he's back. Well, I don't know what happened. You just vanished. All right, so you were explaining the situation with something being intelligently designed to cause this, so then you got cut off.
Okay, I was talking about a ball of yarn. I don't know if you heard that
No.
analogy.
No.
I guess I was gone quite a while. If you think of a ball of yarn, you know, and you look at the surface, you have all these lines that cross it, all different angles and directions. Now, imagine pushing a marble into the center of it. Now, think of what you're looking at there is the orbits of all the various near-Earth asteroids that have, some have, you know, periods of orbits measured in months or a year, and some are measured in several years, that are constantly crossing Earth's path. So, you know, some go around the Earth, some cross it in its path at the near the equator, and none of these things hit the Earth. Now, you know, I have been very intrigued by that for a long time. You know, we have 1,000 very dangerous, you know, classified as what they call PHAs, potentially hazardous asteroids, that cross, you know, near us or cross our plane, and don't hit the Earth. And then there are thousands, some, I think the counts were around 10 to 15,000 other ones that are not dangerous enough to destroy a continent or larger. And yet they don't hit the Earth either. I mean, every once in a great while, you know, we have a meteor come in, and it almost always lands somewhere where no one is. So the question is, all right, is there some force that's keeping these things from hitting the Earth? And could it be the same force or intelligence, as it were, that may be doing something with the sun that we don't even understand? In other words, maybe the nature of our star is such that certain things must be done to it periodically to keep it from erupting. You know, they have seen stars and other solar systems erupt massive coronal mass ejections that would easily consume a planet like our Earth at the distance we are from the sun. I mean, these are massive eruptions that would just totally fry, you know, an orbiting planet. And, you know, and they're seeing these things from light years away, so you can just imagine how huge they must be to see them from Earth. Well, the question is, okay, is somebody, like, maintaining our star, doing things to it? Yeah, because many of these coronal mass ejections we see, most all of them are never aimed at Earth. They go off to some other direction.
Well, you bring up a very, very interesting idea, and it is one that a Mr. James Horak has talked about on this show, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. We need to go to the telephone, and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, can you hear me okay?
You're on the air. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, my name is Gwen, and I'm in Texas.
Okay, Gwen.
Hello.
And let's see. I wanted to ask Kevin, you, and Ted both. You've been talking about the shapes that you've seen on the sun, and I remember that there were some that were seen on Jupiter, I believe, a year or two ago. Is that correct?
Yes, I do seem to recall something about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, are they similar to the ones that appeared on Jupiter?
Well, there's...
The ones on the side of...
I don't know. I didn't actually compare the two, so I don't feel informed enough to answer that question. But, you know, that I have found hexagonal and polygon shapes on most all the bodies, including Mercury, the Moon. There are craters with this shape. I'm not sure why the shape is so prevalent, but these things are pretty well formed. I mean, they're very symmetrically formed, these objects, these craters and what have you. So I'm not sure just what their source actually or origin is.
That's very much a visual effect, and Kevin mentioned harmonics earlier. And I'm wondering if there's a sound that might be producing these patterns.
Did you say a sound?
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me?
Did you say a sound?
Yes, she did.
Hmm.
You know, if you sprinkle sand on a thin piece of metal and put sound waves through that metal from beneath it, the sand will arrange itself in patterns.
Mm-hmm.
So is it possible that there is some type of sound that is causing that on these planets?
Well, you can take a photo detector, put it on a telescope, and connect it to an audio amplifier, and you can actually hear little ringing sounds. There's actually sounds that do come from light sources.
Mm-hmm.
So, certainly the answer is yes. I mean, that's certainly a possibility.
Okay, I'm sorry. You're breaking up really badly.
Yeah, we have a very bad connection with you, Gwen. But thank you for the call. Very interesting question. Whether we can hear sounds or not has absolutely nothing to do whether those sounds are there or not. Dogs can hear frequencies. They literally can hear frequencies that we cannot. And so there is sound, I think, probably throughout the universe.
Yes, I mean, I can hear my wife at least 30 or 40 miles away.
I'm not going to touch that. All right, I've got a flash message here from George in Australia, and George says, greetings, folks. I understand the importance and value of looking at the sun, Earth, solar system, etc., on a mechanical level. However, it is also important to understand that the sun is a living being. So is every other planet and every star. They have life cycles and outcomes of their intentions. what is taking place here is what the relationship between the sun and its planets and the journey that all life within our solar system has chosen to undertake. It is possible to communicate with these beings and know what their intentions are. I do. Okay, George, thank you. That sort of is not the same thing that you were saying about intelligence doing something out there, but it's similar. Is it possible that these heavenly bodies are living beings?
Well, that's a good question. I wrote something about that a few years ago, and you know, is there an intelligence associated with, you know, with things like this? I mean, I started to postulate that because I started looking at, you know, just what really is intelligence. Okay, you take a spider, right? Now, the common spider seems to just know how to make a web. You know, it wasn't taught, you know, it wasn't shown how to make one, but it does know how to make one.
Mm-hmm.
And you put the darn thing almost anywhere, it'll make a web. It'll figure out how to do this and make a pretty good web almost anywhere. So it's clearly not a programmed issue.
Ted, we're going to have to pick up there when we come back because we have got to step away for our final break this evening. We'll be back, folks, right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show, if I can get my voice in gear, and to my guest, Ted Tweetmeyer, and we're on final approach. That means we only have a few minutes left here in this show. Ted, you were talking about spiders and their seemingly innate knowledge of how to build a web.
Yes, and I think what happens is that the intelligence for a lot of life forms comes from the quantum level. That's where they get it from, and you know, that's a whole other story, but we could get into some time. But the question is, could anything have intelligence? Why not? Is my answer. You know, for many years they didn't think animals could even think. Now they find that they have, you know, emotions and feelings like us. I mean, I think elephants were among the first to start showing that to scientists that. You know, and when they lose one of the members of their group, they, you know, they pine over the dead animal, and you know, I mean, they clearly show emotions, and you know, dolphins save the lives of people in trouble. I mean, clearly animals can think and act and react, and so why can't this be extended into other objects in our universe? I don't see why not.
One of the big discussions that I have here on this show from time to time with Dr. Gerald Epling has to do with consciousness. And we started off originally being pretty far apart in our view of what consciousness is, and we're not too far apart now, if at all. But I think that consciousness just is. It just is. And that everything in the universe is a manifestation of that consciousness.
Well, I think with human beings, we have what I call boot code. You know, there's thousands of genes. They don't know what they do in the human genome. Well, you know, just like when you turn your computer on, there's some permanent code in there that allows it to bring in the operating system, you know, whichever painful-to-use operating system you use. but, you know, and then, of course, then it transfers control to that operating system, but there has to be some code that runs when you turn it on for it to even do that. And I think it's true with human beings. You know, we're born, you know, you have to have some basic boot code in there so your eyes function, you know, that when you bring an object closer to your nose, they converge farther away. They start looking, you know, the angles change as you're looking farther away. and all the other basic functions that we need just to start life. So I think there is some, what I call it, boot code or startup code involved in all life forms of some kind.
And what we refer to as the laws of physics, which I think don't exist anyway, but that would be very basic and very powerful boot code that kickstarts the startup of a star or the formation of a planet as well, would it not?
Yeah. We don't even fully understand how planets or stars work. We've never been to the middle of one. You know, we have a lot of theories, and which could be completely wrong, you know. I don't think you can rule something out until you can prove that it's not possible. That's kind of the philosophy I have, which has probably allowed me to do some pretty unusual things, I guess you could say, and discover some unusual things.
All right, now let's go back to where we started as we race toward the end of the show, the denouement of the show. You didn't know I could speak French, did you?
Boy, you're good.
Well, that's right. It's the only French word I know besides oui. I know those two words. But
a lot of listeners should know that you had me on the show not really to talk about this stuff, but to make sure that I appraise you appropriately, right?
That's correct. That's correct.
Of course. That's good.
But as we race toward the end of the show, let's go back to the sun and the phenomena. If all of this phenomena is not being caused by some, we will say, natural forces, i.e. the possibility of a huge celestial body moving towards us, and if it is, as you suggested, at least you suggested the possibility that it is some type of intelligently caused thing that's happening, that's causing all of this phenomena. I want to ask you again, who? Who's doing it?
I kind of like to refer to them as the keepers. I guess that sums it up. I think it was Bob Dean. He said it all just perfectly in one sentence. He said, "We live in a zoo." And what do keepers do for a zoo? They protect it. Protect it.
Mr. James Horak has been on this show and talked about such, I don't know if you would say beings, but things, excessively intelligent, enormously powerful, and he says that even the extraterrestrials are in awe of these things, and he said for lack of any other description, you could perhaps say they are the hand of God. You're referring to them as keepers. I find it interesting that you, as a scientist, have come to not the conclusion, but at least the same possibility, with different words, but the same concept as Mr. Horak.
Yeah, I've been saying this for a few years now. After I couldn't deny the evidence any longer. I started to write a short essay on what I call the reality simulation we live in, which, to quickly say, is, you know, normal computer simulations for, you know, buildings and circuits are just ones and zeros in a computer.
Yeah.
Well, in our reality simulation, we're living a physical reality that's controlled. It's a controlled reality that we live in. And there are plenty of ruins around the planet. Some date back 100,000 years, machined with a precision that we envy today. They're there, they're real, they've been dated with multiple techniques, they exist, you can go put your hand on them, and yet archaeology ignores them, you know, because they don't fit in with the established paradigm. You know, some of those are in Peru.
Yeah.
You know, and the more I dug into this, I ended up with a 65-page book with single-spaced and 12 images in it, and the amount of information became just overwhelming and staggering that it's a control reality, and we are not only that, but we have control of the reality. We can actually change it by what we think and what we focus on. We have more power than we realize, and that's a whole nother show in itself as well, but you know, that's the only explanation for much of the things that are going on. Why we're not hit by asteroids, why the sun doesn't give us a blast and fry the earth, and why all these ruins are out there. I mean, there's physical evidence to back this theory up. I mean, there was an Oxford professor a few years ago said it was like a, he felt a 20% chance that we were in a controlled, he called it a simulation.
Ted, I wish we had more time. We really don't. We are out. I want to thank you for being with us this evening, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. If you will, just stay on the line with me for a moment as we bring this flight of Starship KSS in for a landing. Ladies and gentlemen, that is going to be a wrap for this evening, and I hope you've enjoyed the show. We have more great shows coming each and every night. You don't want to miss a single second of any show, because if you miss a second, just 1 second, you've missed a universe of information. So don't miss a single second. Please remember to help our friends, the Element 115 band, by clicking the link on my website and voting for them. They are friends of the show, friends of the UFO community. Let's be their friend, all right? My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want to call me. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time, so long, everybody.